Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Always a pleasure to be able to share a very empowering hour, and I promise you this will be just that hour. Today we begin with a study from Zhenjiang University in China. They looked at 400,000 people and showed that the most berries consumed gave the greatest benefit to all those and reduced the risk of type 2 diabetes mellitus by almost 18%. Now, mind you, that's one item, berries, in the diet. That's not exercising, which would reduce diabetes, losing weight, which also will help, having things like chromium picolinate, which will help stabilize blood sugar, and B-complex, which also helps. No, you're talking about berries alone. Why? Because the berries are rich in what we call antho, A-N-T-H-O, cyanidins, C-Y-A-N-I-N-S. Now, I suggest the best way of doing it is to find frozen wild blueberries. For a large, almost, I think it's around 3 to 5 pounds, you get that for around $12 or so. And so it's not expensive, and the wild blueberries is the best of all those. This was published in the European Journal of Clinical Nutrition. So now that's not just blueberries. I'm talking about raspberries, boysenberries, mulberries, cherries, tart cherries, Montmorency cherries, all of the different berries, all right? From King's College London, as well as the University of Bristol, unhealthy diet during pregnancy is linked to ADHD. Now, we've known this. This is just one more of the studies that support that. And what they found is a high-fat, high-sugar diet during pregnancy can be linked to symptoms of ADHD in children who show conduct problems early in life. This was published in the Journal of Child Psychology and Psychiatry, and it's the first to indicate the epigenetic changes evident at birth may explain the link between unhealthy diet and conduct problems of ADHD. But I can go a little further than this. In fact, I can go a lot further because I actually did the first study that I'm aware of way back in the 1970s, where I worked with a Dr. Schollenthaler and a Dr. Strauss, and they had already found that by taking sugar and dairy out of prison food, it reduced violence by a substantial margin, and not just in one prison, but across different prisons. So then there was a school teacher in Ohio who saw a difference in the amount of sugar that children came to school having ingested and their ability to sit still, not fidget. So in the early 1970s, I did a study, and I'd worked with a doctor in California, medical doctor, pediatrician, who found that coloring agents, artificial colors, artificial preservatives, also cause children to become hyper. Now, mind you, this is in the children. It's not based upon the parent when the parent was pregnant. And what we did is we took a group of children, took all the sugar out of their diet, artificial sweeteners, artificial flavorings and enhancers and emulsifiers and all the chemicals. For example, they could have a whole millet syrup with bananas and honey and apple juice, but they couldn't have a processed cereal. And we had it based on a vegan diet or vegetarian diet, and it really made the difference. I got so many positive feedback from the parent. What happened to my kid? My kid used to bounce off the walls. Now they're normal. And that's what we found. Now, that was my first experience. But let's jump ahead 20 years. In the mid-1990s, I did another study. And this, I asked people in the audience, if your child has been diagnosed and is being treated for ADD or ADHD, I'm going to do a study. No medicines, but it'll be medically supervised by a board-certified neurologist, highly respected one, and qualified in psychiatrists, plus some nurses with a background in pediatrics. So when they came in the first day, they brought their children, and that was just a mess. They were all over the place, yelling and screaming. And so we said, take your children home, because it's non-productive, and you just come. So, okay. Thereafter, for 6 months, the adults came, and we gave them protocols that I had created. For example, I found that They didn't have healthy gut bacteria, so we gave them probiotics to recolonize healthy bacteria into their gut. Then they got rid of all the dairy, but not all at once. We had them get rid of one particular type of food per week. So 1 week it was all dairy in any form, milk, cheese, yogurt, all gone. The next week it was all meat, anything from an animal, including fish, all gone. The third was all refined carbohydrates, anything that was browned, like a bagel or a pizza crust or pretzel or french fries, potato chips, all gone. Then we got rid of all of the stimulants in the child's diet, like caffeine. No caffeine, no carbonated beverages. Got rid of those. And we replaced them with natural alternatives. In fact, many times the child didn't even know they weren't eating something made from animals because it was all natural. In any case, we then gave them B complex, and the three items most important in the B complex were vitamin B12, folic acid, and these were methylated at a higher dose, but also we found that vitamin choline and inositol, part of the B complex, was also important. Then specifically, we gave nutrients known to impact in a positive way a child's brain. Within 6 months of being on this elimination diet, detoxifying, and rejuvenation diet, rebuilding, 97% of the children returned to completely normal condition. Now, to my knowledge, this was the only study that was done with this type of diet and nutrients and behavior. And it was very easy to find why some of these children were acting out, because the world outside of the classroom was far more interesting than the world in the classroom. Now, some teachers they liked, some classes they liked, and they did well in those. They didn't act out, but in other ones they did. And I remember saying to all the adults, including one who was a psychologist, who had one child, a boy who was acting out, and a medical doctor, a cardiologist, who had three children all acting out. I said, is it possible to have cancer in the morning, all morning, and then no cancer in the evening? No. If you've got cancer, it doesn't come and go. You've got cancer. Okay. And if you're blind, you can't see out of either eye in the morning, but you're completely perfect vision in the afternoon, is that normal? No, that can't happen. If you're blind, you're blind. All right. I said, then why is it that you haven't picked up on the idea your child is getting normal reports by some school teachers because they happen to like the class, they're interested, maybe the teacher's very dynamic, and yet another class, they're bored with it. So they fidget, they look out the window, they daydream. And then at home, they don't seem to have that problem. So anyhow, it was a multidisciplinary approach, but I just want to share with you that yes, this study is important. An unhealthy diet by the mother can then precipitate this in the children. Here's why. It's called EPA, meaning the larger environment, genetics, how everything in the environment you're in, including people, impact your genes expression. And we have thousands upon thousands of articles in the peer-reviewed literature supporting this. And this is a tough one, and I'll tell you why. Because I worked at the New York Center for Marital Guidance for about 20 years. It was founded by Dr. Lane Kahn from Columbia University, an outstanding psychologist, brilliant person. We authored several books together. We were close personal friends, and she was involved in a lot of the studies that I did, studying the outcomes and what happened to broaden her own perspective. I had other psychologist friends who did the same. And we were always struck by the idea of how are some people acting out, and yet there's nothing in their life that we can find that causes this acting out. But why would someone suddenly go into one mood or another mood when there's no precipitating events? What we didn't know at that time was this was epigenetic. But one day, and this was a fluke, I was going to go to lunch with my buddy, Dr. Morton Jacobs, and a person was coming out of his office, and they were talking, and they stood right in front of me. I wasn't eavesdropping. They were just, Morty was standing right in front of me talking with this guy. He says, well, I'll see you next month. You're good for a month now. You won't have any symptoms. So I was just curious. Why does he come once a month? What medical condition does he have? And I'm asking him, the guy, what medical condition you have, if you want to answer that, that would be Epigenetic. Oh, no problem. He's, I manage a bank, and every month I get this excruciating back pain, and it literally incapacitates me for 1 to 2 days. I said, and then it goes away? After, you know, Morty works on me, yes. I see. Would you be willing to just, at no cost, just I'll pay for it, to have the best hypnotherapist, psychologist in New York do a regressive hypnosis on you? He said, what's that? I said, it takes you back before your conscious awareness that something might have happened early in life that locked in a proclivity of fear, pain, and now you express it even though that event is long gone. He said, sure. Within a week, we had him into a psychologist's office that I work with, and he took him back, and it was interesting because his voice actually changed. You actually hear people when they're undergoing hypnosis. First of all, they don't think they're hypnotized. Well, I'm hearing everything. I'm not hypnotized. Yeah, you are. And so then when he starts becoming a child, and the psychologist said, look at this picture book of this year. All right. You're 5 years old. What do you see on the picture book you don't like that frightens you or makes you fearful? And then you go back to the next year. It was when he was 4 years old. He was taking dishes off the table, and he tripped on the rug, and one of the dishes broke. And his father yelled at him that he was irresponsible, couldn't be trusted to do something as simple as taking dishes. And he went into a corner, and he held his shoulders up, and he looked down, and he froze all that tension, that epigenetic energy the father just shared with him, into his back and neck. Now, what happens every month in his life? He has a bank meeting, and now his supervisor comes in. And in his mind, without even being conscious of it, at the subconscious level, that's his father. Did he do right? Did he not do right? All right? And then that impacts the epigenetics. So, the psychologist changes the scenario and says, take all the plates, but don't take them to the kitchen. Bring them over here because we're going to break them. This is a Greek tradition of celebrating life, and we're going to break all the dishes and laugh. And then he says to him under hypnosis, because I'm there, I'm watching all this, he says, now just remember, I'm giving you this hug because nothing you will do in your life will make me stop loving you. And they brought him out. One session, and the guy never again had a pain in his neck. That's the epigenetic phenomena. So then when I saw this, then I went to people who were doing rebirthing. I went through all the, and I filmed it. It's in one of my earlier films on de-stressing naturally. I did two. This was the first one. Boy, I saw stuff that you just, I saw stuff with Qigong that you could, and by the way, the Qigong person I'd never met, but he was considered the best in New York, and my producer had found him, and I had a person that no one knew what the person's problem was, because I didn't want any bias. So we took this person in, and the Qigong person comes in, has never met any of us, I got the film rolling, and he goes over to him, and way up here around his chest, he just takes his hands, spreads them out over the person's body, and then back. Then suddenly he focuses right in on one part of the body. And his hands are right above, and I see the person whose eyes are closed, his body starts to heave up. And so I'm thinking, that's interesting. So I go over and I put my hand on beyond air, probably 80 degrees. I put my hand between his hand, which is not touching the person's body, and the person's body. My goodness, it was like putting it into an oven. The heat was phenomenal. I had to pull my hand back. And he was generating energy, life energy, chi, that he had created into this person's body. Well, two things happened. that person had completely relief of what he had been going through, a medical condition, but no one in that room knew what his condition was or where it was. But the person with Qigong saw it, read it, healed it. I'm not going to go further into energy exchange, but that's just one little aspect of energy exchange. And but you will see this in the film, by the way, this whole episode, and a lot of other interesting things. In any case, the more I studied epigenetics, the more I realized how many people are walking around today with insecurity, fear, unrequited anger, but nonspecific, a sense of foreboding or dread, yet there's nothing that they could say is an existential reason for this to happen. Normal lives, and yet a person reacts as if something's not normal happening to them, not realizing that could have been from their parents, grandparents. It can go back seven generations. Now, can you release this? Yes, you can. I'm not going to deal with it on today's show because I'm already over the time I'd normally allot for a health area. But we did this, by the way, with a lot of people who were unhealthy, and it made a big difference, especially those with ADD and ADHD, because frequently we found if the parent, one or both, were hyper or angry or lived kind of an over-the-top way of communicating, very loud, very boisterous, very direct, the child picked that up at the epigenetic level. That meant that the child was experiencing that while it was developing in the fetus. Just saying. So, one more problem that we're looking at, and realizing the mother's nutrition, the mother's emotional state, more than nutrition, will directly impact the developing child's health. Now, another study, and this is from Northwestern University, brain waves of distressed patients slow to meditative state as a violinist plays. Yeah. If you, in this case, they took a viola music and found that it calms agitated epilepsy patients, and as seen in their brain waves when they're hospitalized in the epilepsy monitoring unit. This is brand new. This is really interesting. Okay, if it worked for epilepsy, why wouldn't it work for just people who are stressed? Why not? And hence the idea. Remember I said you could have different types of music and try them. There are thousands of CDs out there. Let's say you try the flute, or you try a harp, or try a violin. Try rain on a tin roof. Try a thunderstorm. All of these relax us. Brings us to a theta state. Brings us out of an alpha state, beta state. So that can make a difference. That can also renormalize the electrical charges to our heart, to our liver, to our brain. And that's important as well. So good that they did this study, great study, but then apply it in other areas as well. Now that's the latest on health and healing. We're going to take a break, come right back. And also for those of you who have not gone over and taken a look at the Gary Noll newsletter, you ought to do so. Packed with information. And those who sign up get, and it's a small fee, you get the newest stories, essays, and information that's not available anywhere. Back in a moment. We have a lot to share. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Noll. This is going to be an unusual program because I have not one, but two original commentaries to share with you that were written just in the last day, because I was concerned about things happening that I did not see any kind of pushback or challenge to. But before we go there, I just want to comment on something that was in the front page of New York Post today, and it's daughter's cry after mom, 60 years of age, beaten by a serial criminal. Quote, "You all did nothing." And if you're not familiar with this, and I'm sure anyone in the New York area is, because of it in all the media, a serial criminal took a woman's cane and for 2 straight minutes, minimally, beat her almost to death. Now, here's what's important, and this goes back to something I mentioned after my last visit to New York City. And that was, as I saw at Lincoln Center and walked clear down, I walked from 89th and Broadway down to 63rd and Broadway. I saw at least 5 people who were acting out. These were people who clearly had mental issues. Now, these are not the drunks or drug addicts who I also saw, but they weren't bothering anyone. But there was one instance at Lincoln Center where a person had a long steel rod and was swinging at anybody's head, crashing windows of cars. And he looked at me and he started to come, and I'm thinking, okay, I'll disarm him. I'm not going to hurt him. My intent is not to hurt someone, but then I'll put him in a lock until the police get there. Then they can take him, because clearly he's got mental issues. But fortunately, just as he was looking across the street, the light changed and all these cars came. And I thought, there were at least 20 people that walked by this person, and they just walked out of his way. But no one called the police. In this case, when I came back, I said, you know, a city is in decline, rapid, precipitous decline, when the citizens maladapt to a new normal. Now, walking up Broadway from my office in mid-Manhattan, I walked up. It took me about 2 hours because I walked up through Times Square, which was a zoo. I walked over to 8th Avenue, where all the migrants were. And then I walked on up past, and then around 57th Street it changed, and then you would think you were in a normal, back to the Upper West Side. And just so you understand, the Upper West Side from 57th and Broadway and Central Park over to the Hudson River up to Columbia University around 120th Street is the most concentrated of successful, highly educated, wealthy people in the world in history. Okay, good. And that meant that historically, if I walked down, which I did almost every night, to Lincoln Center and see if there was anything, one of the art movies or at the Beacon Theater where I could see a concert, I would relax after a long day. And you would count the different shops. Every single store was taken. You'd have boutiques and diners and specialty food stores, shoe repair, dry cleaners, organic dry cleaners, have all these wonderful stores, all that serve the people in the neighborhood. And that was a nice thing. Now, starting about 5 years ago, and I had my brother on, Stephen, who is the unpaid spokesperson for 45 years, almost a half a century, of the small business people in New York. And at that time, you started to see all the small businesses gone, empty, 33% vacancy, permanent vacancy, up and down the main boulevards of Manhattan and other places in Brooklyn and Queens, etc. And they weren't coming back because the cost of rent was just going through the roof and people just couldn't afford it. There's a point where you're just working for everyone else, not yourself. But after COVID, it then became like San Francisco and downtown Los Angeles, 40% vacancies. But worse still was that you had crime, because nobody was being arrested for shoplifting. Now, they are in other cities, but not 14 cities in the United States. The victim of a crime is not helped. The perpetrator of the crime is constantly released, even with serious crimes, knifing someone, attempted murder, rape. And this shouldn't exist, but it does. The trouble is, on the Upper West Side, where I lived my entire adult life, nobody seemed to care because it wasn't their neighborhood. Now, immediately that tells me something about the nature of people's indifference, selfishness to other human beings. Okay, that's fine. If you want to be greedy, you want to be selfish, you want to be self-absorbed, a careerist, go for it, take no prisoners, have no morals of what you do, that's your business. But don't at the same time call yourself liberal. You're not. You're a fraud. And boy, I can tell you stories about how I showed that. But that's a different time, and I don't have the time right now. But I will show you how I saw this happening 20 years ago. And I said, wow, these wealthy people don't want to see poor people in the park, Riverside Park, when they go in the park in the morning. So they got the cops telling these people about 5 o'clock, get out of your little knapsacks or whatever you're sleeping in, little boxes, and hide that stuff and get out of the park. Because when the wealthy elite come in here, they don't want to be depressed by seeing poor people. And that's exactly what the police told me, because I stopped a cop car and I asked him, well, what the hell's going on here? I'm seeing a long line of guys every morning when I go for a run down here, because I run early, and they're quiet. They go up to a waterfall. Why can't they use the bathroom there? There's a toilet there. Well, that's just for the people who live on the Upper West Side, and that was going to open later so they don't use it. Why can't they use it? Why can't a person that's had no bed to sleep in, no toilet to use, why can't they go in there in the morning, use the toilet, at least use the sink to wash up? So they're at a cold water fountain, including in the winter, brushing their teeth, shaving, and I stood there and watched them. I talked with hundreds of them. These were decent human beings coming from war-torn areas that we created in Central and South America, but nobody wanted to see them. Ah, so you're the kind of liberal that doesn't want to see anyone who's suffering. And you're supposed to be for the suffering. Well, that's the New Democrat. In any case, I said, you'll know when the city is non-redeemable, will not be changed, and will continue on the slippery slope when people become maladapted, and there's the key, maladapted to their environment. So, the headline of the paper today, quote, you all did nothing. Of course they didn't. Did you expect them to? Do you know how many other times they did nothing but take selfies and get it up on TikTok? So a person's watching someone being beaten to death, but they don't call the police. No, I got to get this up on TikTok. Wow. Does that tell us a lot about how we've maladapted? And it's just the beginning. More on San Francisco, a whole documentary on San Francisco I'm going to be presenting in the next 2 weeks to show you. New York is right behind you and catching up fast. And you'll see when the schools were overrun, when crime is so rampant. And by the way, did anyone mention that there were 15 cars stolen in Brooklyn and Bronx, Mercedes-Benz, Porsches, out of people's driveway and garages? No arrest. And if they were arrested, what's going to happen to them? You don't deserve the Porsche. So go up back out on the street. This guy who beat this woman, guess what? He was released. Of course he was. Because beating a African-American 60-year-old elderly woman almost to death, well, that's clearly something on her, not him, right? Wow. So don't tell me any longer. I don't want to speak with anyone ever again about how they're really concerned. Well, show me your concern. And a whole city has lost its concern. It's lost its mind. So let's see what happens in the interim. That said, I just wanted to share that because I told you this was going to happen. I said when people can walk around a problem but not address it, not try to change it, not try to change the circumstances of it, then you have a mass psychosis of dysfunction. That's exactly what Manhattan has become. Now I'm going to share my first commentary. I have two. Recently, Reason magazine published an article which was clearly an attack on the character of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. And Jimmy Dore, to his credit, defended Robert Kennedy, but also he had no science on his side. He just said this is terrible journalism and this person is not right about this. And he was correct, but I wanted to do a little more. I wanted to show you what is happening now in right across. I mean, from the Daily Beast, you would expect this. But from Reason Magazine, this I didn't expect. So the title of my commentary is Reason Magazine's Unreasonable Character Assassination of Robert Kennedy Jr. And it's posted on GaryNull.com. Today, the largest purveyor of misinformation and fabricated propaganda is the United States government. And the think tanks, the compromised NGOs, which are most, social media, and the mainstream corporate media. Behind this web and its false narratives is a network of powerful special interest groups who fund scriptwriters and journalists, traitors to their profession, in order to promulgate their message. This certainly seems to be the case of a hit piece targeting Robert Kennedy Jr. recently printed in the libertarian publication Reason. Liz Wolf's smear job is only one among many efforts to criticize and delegitimize Kennedy as a viable presidential candidate and to associate him with conspiracy theories. The rise in Kennedy's popularity in the polls clearly shows he represents a very real challenge to the status quo in Washington. As the campaign season proceeds, we can expect to see many more such sullied articles, and they will increase in direct proportion to the threats Kennedy poses as he goes up in the polls. For many, Kennedy's appearance in the presidential race is a breath of fresh air for voters across the political spectrum. He represents those higher ideals of his father and his uncle. Traditional Democrats despair at the party's lack of substance. This segment are older, more educated, more independent, yet cling to the party out of loyalty, while simultaneously being fed up with the Clinton Wall Street New Democrats and their duplicity, their lack of traditional liberal ideals, and its growing legacy of deceit and dishonesty. This arrives at a time when a July Gallup poll found America's faith in our political institutions at a historical low, with public confidence in the presidency at 26% and Congress at 8%. The television news and prejudiced print media, which Wolf represents, are equal in their dismal lows of 14% and 18% respectively. Therefore, it is understandable that Kennedy would worry the ideologues in Washington because they are at loggerheads over what might happen to their control over national policy if he were elected. What they can be certain of is that Kennedy will not be as compliant and manageable as Clinton, Bush Jr., Obama, Biden, and certainly a lot smarter and more ethical than Trump. We therefore offer a simple rebuttal to this so-called journalist and challenge Reason's editorial board for their serious negligence, in our opinion, in properly vetting a cheap screed that is demonstrably false. Popular internet personalities such as Jimmy Dore, with no medical or scientific background whatsoever, are capable of identifying Wolf's distortions and untruths. Her article should rightly tarnish the journal's credibility and call into motivation the questions being raised. Wolf's Reason article purports to be an objective critique based upon scientific evidence, especially regarding vaccines and infectious disease. Instead, she fails to support any of her maligned accusations with reliable evidence. For a person who writes about sex workers, tattoo parlors, cancel culture, the tech industry, and free speech, in our opinion, her essay displays all of the features of the intellectually challenged and incapacity to tackle complex subjects that are beyond her technical comprehension. But that is no surprise. It is characteristic of today's dominant culture of journalism. This is the kind of journalism one might expect from politically motivated tabloids such as the Daily Beast, which has a propensity, in our opinion, to commission any nickel and dime journalist to knock off op-eds solely for the purpose of discoloring truth and facts. Because Wolf's personal opinions are so disproportionately misinformed, her rhetoric is thoroughly derogatory, bordering on libel. Kennedy, on many occasions since announcing his presidency and candidacy, has been challenged about his stance on vaccine safety. Repeatedly, he has retold the story about filing a complaint in the U.S. Southern District of New York court against the Department of Health and Human Services for its failure to provide not one single documented example of any vaccine on the CDC's children's vaccine schedule showing that it has been properly tested against a placebo, like all pharmaceutical drugs before licensure. By Health and Human Services' own admission, Kennedy stated no such clinical trials exist. Here's what she could have found had she checked. The court document states, I'm reporting directly from the court document, U.S. Southern District of New York. Quote, the department's researchers for records did not locate any records responsive to your request. The Department of Health and Human Services' immediate office of the secretary conducted a thorough search of its document tracking system. Also conducted a comprehensive review of all the relevant indexes of records maintained at the Federal Reserve records centers, end quote. Now, except for those mentally handicapped, what other proof is necessary? The federal agency's attempts to explain away the rationale for the absence of placebo-controlled studies in pre-licensure vaccine clinical trials violates all scientific standards for efficacy and safety, and I mean all. Well, what do you think their statement was? Here we enter the twilight zone of corporate science and encounter perhaps one of the most ludicrous declarations in the history of modern medicine. Here's what the top health agency in America had to say. Quote, inert placebo controls are not required to understand the safety profile of a new vaccine and are thus not required. In some cases, inclusion of placebo-controlled groups is considered unethical. Even in the absence of a placebo, control groups can be useful for evaluating whether the incidence of a specific observed adverse event exceeds that which would be expected without administration of new vaccine. End quote. Wow. This is voodoo medicine and magical thinking. However, there are no words of witch doctors, but rather are senior government health officials responsible for the public safety of children's health and well-being. Besides, there is a voluminous body of peer-reviewed scientific papers showing a strong causal relationship between toxic vaccine ingredients and the rise in childhood neurological disorders. Biology professor Brian Hooker, and a father of a vaccine-injured autistic son, recently published one of the few thorough studies to date comparing the health status between vaccinated and unvaccinated children. Hooker's and his colleagues, Dr. Neil Miller's, results reported a statistically significant higher incidence of lower mental development, inflammatory gastrointestinal disorders, asthma, and ear infections among those who were vaccinated, but not those who were not. Wolf's argument that the high rate of delayed mental conditions such as autism or ADHD is simply a consequence of undiagnosed cases is at its core disingenuous. It is also stupid. Preparing for this rebuttal to Wolf's widely opinionated germate into context, we have been unable to find a single robust study in the National Library of Medicine that even suggests Wolf's claim might be reasonable. Moreover, Kennedy has never placed all of the blame for the rise in autism and other neurological developmental disorders on vaccines. As a seasoned environmental attorney for several decades, he is knowledgeable about other environmental toxins found in common everyday household products that contribute to neurological development delays. Wolf could have at least conducted a very simple internet search to discover exposure to methylmercury, PCBs, brominated flame retardants, endocrine disruptors, organic pesticides, etc., among the top 10 environmental contributors to autism and learning disabilities. A recent study from Hebrew University in Jerusalem has confirmed earlier evidence that fetal phthalates, quote, in everywhere plastic, end quote, interfere with emotional and behavioral development issues in two-year-old boys. Taking a side smack at Dr. Andrew Wakefield, Wolf has evidently fallen into the same rabbit hole as every other pro-vaccine ideologue before her to accuse the British gastroenterologist specialist as the father of the anti-vaccine movement. No, that was not Andrew Wakefield. In fact, 30 years before Andrew Wakefield, there were a number of physicians who were challenging the safety and efficacy of vaccines. And their proverb on this was simple. Take a group of children who have had no vaccines and follow them after you do all of your psychological and physiological blood workups to see what is the state of health, then take a group, same number, cross-matched, who've had all the childhood vaccines, and then follow them each on a regular six-month basis for 5 years. It's never been done. Why not? Easy enough to do. That would tell you, are the vaccines safe and effective or not? But they haven't done it. That's not because they couldn't or didn't want to. They would know the outcome. As a result, Wakefield's article was not about anti-vaccines. Wakefield had a whole group of gastroenterologists, including one of the world's most famous, and they published an article in The Lancet. It was retracted, and it had no reference to the mRNA vaccine at all as the cause of autism. The paper states, quote, "We have identified a chronic enterocolitis in children that may be related to neuropsychiatric dysfunction. In most cases, onset symptoms was after measles, mumps, and rubella immunization. Further investigations are needed to examine the syndrome and its possible relation to this vaccine," end quote. Wakefield and all these were challenged, and through a kangaroo court, they managed to take away all their licenses. But the head head doctor filed suit and won. And in the highest court in Great Britain, they excoriated the medical commission and its investigation of these people, and in effect said it's all fraud. And he was exonerated. I didn't hear a single apology for those individuals who attack Wakefield and his group. Not one. But the world doesn't want to know about what happened afterwards. Wakefield solely reported an association between vaccine-induced enterocolitis and neuropsychiatric dysfunction. Nor did the study make any reference to the MMR as a possible causal agent for autism. Now, since the Wakefield incident, later independent research has confirmed his original reporting to be accurate. In her accusatory potshot at Kennedy and Wakefield as the culprits who, quote, stoke, end quote, anti-vaccination frenzy, we can observe the utter sloppiness in her research. Remarking on the 2015 and 2019 measles outbreak as a result of a decline in vaccination compliance, Wolf's sole reference is an article published in 2010, 5 years before the events she reports on. Furthermore, the notion of the MMR vaccine's success in eradicating mumps has no merit whatsoever. Mumps outbreaks most often occur among the most heavily vaccinated populations. This is not speculation. It was the conclusion of the FDA Center for Biologic Evaluation. Moreover, in 2014, a Pennsylvania court ruled the two Merck virologists' lawsuit against the MMR manufacturer will go to trial. The scientists' charges are that Merck's claims of its mumps vaccine's effectiveness is knowingly false and was part of Merck's business strategy to deceive health authorities for financial advantage in order to monopolize the market. At that time, Merck's mumps vaccine earned the company $621 million. The case is now expanded into antitrust litigation against the vaccine maker for misleading the public. Wolf's attempt to debunk Kennedy's comments about the rise of polio cases in relation to the vaccine is again poorly researched. First, the World Health Organization claims about 99% decline in global polio cases has been held suspect for many. We might remind ourselves that this is an organization that has been repeatedly wrong about many of its pandemic predictions and preventative policies, including the H1N1 swine flu, Zika virus, Ebola pandemic scares, none of that could even be ruled as serious epidemics. Although the polio vaccine has been discontinued in developed nations due to the adverse risk of the polio-like paralysis, or acute flaccid paralysis, it is still administered in poorer developed nations for one sole purpose, it is easier to manufacture and more cost effective. Now, again, acute flaccid paralysis continues to affect polio vaccinated populations in the thousands. One of the most nefarious vaccination boondoggles launched by Bill Gates occurred in rural India in 2011, within a year following a massive vaccination campaign with an increased dosage of the poliovax virus due to its failure to generate an adequate immune response. There were over 53,500 reported cases of non-polio acute flaccid paralysis, which is clinically indistinguishable from the wild polio paralysis, yet far more fatal. The Indian health authorities investigated and found when they published the results in April to June 2012, issue of the Indian Journal of Medical Ethics, and a legal suit was filed against Gates. Unsurprising, despite the evidence to the contrary, Bill Gates and the World Health Organization announced India was a polio-free nation in 2014. Again, this is another sleight-of-hand performance of vaccine voodoo. A later study reported that there have been 490,000 cases of polio-like paralysis in India between 2000 and 2017. In his article, Assessing the Polio Vaccine's History and Efficacy, appearing in the journal Medical Veritas, Dr. Neil Miller recounts various incidents of polio outbreaks due to river and sewage contamination. Most poignantly was a Japanese discovery of a new infectious polio strain found in Tokyo's waterways. After genetic sequencing, the novel mutation was traced back to, you guessed it, the polio vaccine. If Robert Kennedy is correct and all of our federal health agencies are wrong, then millions of young children's lives are at risk. Oddly, for a new mother whose child now faces the CDC's childhood vaccination schedule, Wolf seems unwilling to critically evaluate the potential risks that Kennedy has been warning about for two decades. Seemingly, Wolf is far more concerned with political virtue signaling in order to pull the rug over the eyes of Reason's predominant libertarian readership and revile Kennedy on a host of topics she vehemently takes out of context, in our opinion. Yet overall, we believe Wolf's article is so shoddy, it would unlikely pass for a poor senior high school research paper. Her level of shock journalism could be mistaken for the berating diatribes of a Rachel Maddow or Sean Hannity or Hassan or Joy Reid. This is tabloid fiction, in our opinion, at its finest. Reason's senior editors should also be held to account for their failure to fact-check and conduct due diligence on Wolf's sophomoric effort. Their publication has been discredited, and people should avoid it at all costs. If Wolf's essay is any indication of the quality of Reason's contents, there is nothing to be gained by giving it further attention. One measure that determines the integrity of a journalist who specializes in character assassination is to invite them to a public forum for a debate. However, at no time during my 50 years as a national broadcast host and investigative journalist, as a journalist I have confronted on any health issue, accepted the challenge. Kennedy likely would not be learned enough to debate Wolf about the merits of tattoos, but I'm certain she would never accept the opportunity to back up her disparaging remarks and her shameless medical ignorance to debate Kennedy publicly. Let us hope that I'm wrong on that. I would host a debate, diplomatically done, between both parties. And that is my response to that. Your thoughts, 888-874-4888. And now I'm going to hold my other commentary because I'm looking at the clock till tomorrow. Instead, I want to play a few clips. On yesterday's program, I mentioned that if all I did was talk about health, give you the positive news, I'd be doing people a disservice, because it is all the work I've done throughout my entire career warning you of the dangers of, and then just check off the list. DDT, which I helped ban, and Eldrin, Heptachlor, Copper Coil 7, hundreds and hundreds of items. So at least people would have an idea that, well, Gary says that there's something to be concerned about using this product. Maybe I should do more homework before I use it. Let me just give you an example. Here is a doctor, medical doctor, mainstream, not alternative, and he is highlighting why you should know the truth about medicine. We're going to go clip two. These medications increase the risk of blood clots. Here you know, and you should, because your life could depend upon it.
Hi everyone, Dr. Sunil Dand, internal medicine physician. Welcome to another video. In this video, I would like to talk about medications, common prescription medications, which are associated with an increased risk of blood clots. Now, obviously, blood clots are a phenomenon which no one wants to get. They can range from very mild to very serious or even fatal. And there are different types of blood clots. Blood clots can occur in the veins, they can occur in the arteries, and they can occur in different parts of the body. They can occur distally in the legs, what we commonly call a DVT or deep vein thrombosis, or they can spread up to the lungs, what we call a pulmonary embolus or pulmonary emboli, if there are lots of them. So let me share with you here some common prescription medication classes which are associated with an increased risk of blood clots. Now, obviously, if you're on any of these medications, it doesn't mean that you'll definitely get a blood clot, but there is evidence of an increased risk of blood clots, and it obviously depends on many other factors as well. So please speak to your doctor, but let me share these with you here. Number one, oral contraceptives, birth control pills, particularly those containing estrogen, are associated with an increased risk of both DVTs and pulmonary embolus. Number two, hormone replacement therapy. Along the same lines, particularly those containing estrogen, are associated with a higher incidence of blood clots. These are drugs which are prescribed to help control menopausal symptoms. Number three, antidepressants. Interestingly, studies have shown that many different classes of antidepressants, including common ones such as SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, tricyclic antidepressants, are associated with an increased risk of blood clots. And there's some debate over why this occurs. Could it be a direct effect on platelets, a component of the blood? This is up for debate, but studies have shown an increased rate. There is also debate over whether it's the actual antidepressant or the effect of the antidepressant, including weight gain and immobility. But that's what studies have shown, an increased risk potentially of blood clots. Number four, antipsychotic medications. Now, we live in a time and a culture where prescriptions for mental health issues are absolutely going through the roof. And there's certain antipsychotic medications. One that springs to mind is clozapine, which has been shown to increase the risk of blood clots. So that's certainly something to keep in mind if you or your family member is on one of these medications. Number five, any medication which increases the risk of immobility. Now, this covers a broad range of medications, any sedative, any benzodiazepine, any muscle relaxant, but it's simple common sense that any medication which will increase immobility will decrease blood flow to the legs and increase the risk of blood clots forming. And that has been shown in...
So just imagine how many people may be using birth control pills, women in this case, and also be anxious or depressed or having some other problem, that they're taking any one of these six medications that really increase the risk of stroke, all right, and blood clots. So isn't it important that you know the negative so you can watch out for it, prevent it, not just the positive? By the way, we want to help our sister station, WBAI, and one of the ways we can do that is be a buddy. To be a buddy for BAI, you just donate a small amount of money each month. It's automatic. Whatever you can afford, $15, $20, $25. It really helps them. Please be a buddy. 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. And be a buddy to this wonderful station. All right? WBAI. We're going to go to the top of the hour. Hopefully we'll have people call in because you'd like to share your thoughts. And our talkback number is 888-874-4888, prn.live, if you want to continue joining us. I want to play you a clip about Vladimir Putin and how everyone who now hates him at one time was praising him, working with him towards peace. Listen to what they have to say in this short clip.
Is this a man that Americans can trust?
I looked the man in the eye. I found him to be very straightforward and trustworthy. We had a very good dialogue. I was able to get a sense of his soul. I wouldn't have invited him to my ranch if I didn't trust him.
Well, here's Biden 20 years ago praising Vladimir Putin for moving toward democracy.
I'm close to amazed by how far Putin seems to have come in making throwing his lot with the West. I don't think anybody since Peter the Great has made such a significant, at least initial move to the West.
Trouver un homme très au fait de ses dossiers, très calme, très intelligent.
Mr. Putin is he's very smart.
Well, you know him better than most people.
Yeah, I do. We had a really good, blunt relationship.
Did Putin ever renege on a personal agreement he made to you?
He did not.
So behind closed doors, he could be trusted?
He kept his word in all the deals we made.
We have to understand the scale of the problems that the president of Russia has to deal with, and they're unlike any of the problems that any of the rest of us in the Western world have to deal with. I mean, he's dealing with an economy that needs absolutely fundamental restructuring, civic society that needs to be rebuilt after the years of communism, and external relations that have a whole series of historical legacies that have to be overcome. So I don't think it's surprising that he is and presents himself as a strong leader, as a patriotic leader for Russia.
I am confident that this new level of cooperation between NATO's members and Russia will now change the world and for the better.
I got along with him great, but ultimately he's going to take over all of Ukraine.
Okay, a few thoughts. Who kept moving NATO and agitating to get nuclear weapons, biological labs into Ukraine on Russia's border? All right? Go back. Who caused a coup and threw out the democratically elected, even most of them were corrupt, the president of Ukraine, United States, Gloria Nuland, and our State Department in Obama's White House? Who then set the stage for pushing by proxy Ukraine into this war, where they've lost upwards of casualties, dead and wounded, and amputees, over 400,000 individuals. 14 million people left the country. Why don't we have any of the journalists in America do an honest report on this conflict? And it could have been brought to a stop over a year ago, but Boris Yeltsin said no to that. Our White House said no. This is purely gaining the benefit of the military-industrial complex. But we're not looking at the larger issue. If we did, then we would have a different perspective of Putin and this conflict and the powers that be behind the scenes who thrive on war and conflict. Just my thoughts. We don't have any calls. Wish we did. I'd take them. In any case, thank you all for listening. And if you didn't listen to last night's program, whoa, go to our archives and download last night's Progressive Commentary Hour. Have a nice day, everyone.